Hello, this is Brian, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 2nd issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Federal prosecutors say Afghan national made bomb threat on TikTok video in Texas. A Texas man has been charged with making threats online after authorities said a video showing him threatening to build a bomb, conduct a suicide attack, and kill Americans was posted to TikTok and other social media sites. The charge against Mohammed Dawood Alokoze, an Afghan national, was filed Saturday in federal court. He has not yet had an opportunity to enter a plea, and court records do not reveal if he had obtained an attorney. The Federal Public Defender's Office did not immediately respond to a voicemail left by the Associated Press. The Texas Department of Public Safety alerted the FBI on November 25 that a video shared by multiple social media accounts showed a video call in which a man claiming to live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area threatening to build a bomb in his vehicle and kill the others on the call. The man said the Taliban were dear to him, FBI Special Agent Justin Killian said in a court document describing the video. The FBI used facial recognition technology to identify Alokoze as the man in the video, and he was arrested the same day. Killian said Alokoze admitted making the statements and said he deleted his TikTok application from his phone after people contacted him saying that they had seen the video on social media. This Afghan national came into America during the Biden administration and, as alleged, explicitly stated that he came here in order to kill American citizens, Attorney General Pamela Bondi said in a press release. The public safety threat created by the Biden administration's vetting breakdown cannot be overstated. The Department of Justice will continue working with our federal and state partners to protect the American people from the prior administration's dangerous incompetence. About 76,000 Afghans who helped Americans were brought to the country as the Taliban took Afghanistan back over in 2021 under a program called Operation Allies Welcome. Alokoze was initially arrested on a state charge of making a terroristic threat. Homeland Security Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs Tricia McLaughlin announced their arrest on the social media platform X on Saturday, one day after the Trump administration halted all asylum decisions and paused issuing visas for people traveling on Afghan passports. Those moves came after two National Guard members were shot Wednesday in Washington. Federal authorities have identified the suspect in the shooting near the White House as Ramanullah Lakhanwal, a 29-year-old Afghan national who worked with the CIA during the Afghanistan war. He applied for asylum during the Biden administration and was granted it this year under President Donald Trump, according to a group that assists with resettlement of Afghans who helped U.S. forces in their country. Neither McLaughlin nor U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Texas, Ryan Raybould, indicated any connection between the cases. U.S. Envoy Witkoff meets Putin in Moscow. U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff was meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow on Tuesday, taking a draft peace plan that Washington hopes can bring about an end to the nearly four-year war in Ukraine. Putin, however, ahead of the talks, accused Ukraine's European allies of sabotaging U.S.-led efforts to end the war, calling their demands absolutely unacceptable. U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, would join the meeting, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters. He said the talks would take as long as needed and involve only Witkoff, Kushner, and an interpreter from the U.S. side. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Ireland during his European tour to sustain support against Russia's invasion. According to a draft of Trump's plan obtained last month by the Associated Press, it would cede land to Russia and limit the size of Kiev's military. Ukraine and European allies have been working with U.S. officials to amend the plan. Meeting has begun between Putin and U.S. envoy. Putin is now meeting with Witkoff and Kushner in Moscow for talks on ending the fighting in Ukraine. The meeting comes days after U.S. officials held talks with a Ukrainian delegation on the U.S. peace plan. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters it was productive, but more work needed to be done. Putin threatens retaliation over strikes on vessels carrying Russian oil. Putin also threatened retaliation for Ukrainian strikes on vessels carrying Russian oil in Turkey's exclusive economic zone. He said Moscow would expand the range of its strikes against Ukrainian ports and ships. He also said Moscow would consider the possibility of retaliatory measures against the vessels of countries helping Ukraine to carry out such strikes. Putin accuses Europe of not having a peace agenda. Putin has accused Ukraine's European allies of sabotaging U.S.-led efforts to end the war, asserting that they don't have a peace agenda, they're on the side of the war. The Russian leader accused Europe of amending peace proposals with demands that are absolutely unacceptable to Russia, thus blocking the entire peace process, only to blame Russia for it. His remarks were in line with the narrative that Russia pushed after Trump came to office earlier this year and initiated talks with Moscow. Putin urges journalists to visit areas he says are now in Russian hands. Speaking with journalists, Putin asserted that Moscow's troops had taken control of the eastern Ukrainian city of Pokrovsk. He said it has special significance because from this sector, the Russian army can easily advance in any direction that the general staff deems most promising. Putin invited foreign journalists to visit Pokrovsk. Ukraine has denied that Russian troops have taken control of the city. Ukraine's general staff described Putin's new statements as a propaganda stunt. It said on social media that the Ukrainian army was preparing additional routes to deliver supplies to troops in the area. Zelensky says U.S. taking serious steps to end the war in one way or another. Speaking at a press conference in Dublin, Zelensky said, "There are now 20 points that were drafted in Geneva and were finalized in Florida. Some things still have to be worked on. From what I've seen, America takes serious steps to end the war in one way or another. And our mission, I am sure this is our common mission of everyone in Europe, is to truly end this war and not just make a pause in hostilities. We need decent peace, and for it to truly happen, everyone has to be on the side of peace. Ukraine belongs in the European Union." Ireland's leader announced $145 million in new funding for Ukraine during President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to Dublin on Tuesday. Prime Minister Michael Martin said his government will provide 100 million euros in non-lethal military assistance and 25 million euros to support Ukraine's energy system. He said Russia has been deliberately, cynically attacking Ukraine's energy infrastructure as winter approaches. Martin said Ireland would try to push forward negotiations on Ukraine joining the European Union, saying, "Ukraine is part of our European family. It shares the same values. It belongs in the European Union." Zelensky arrives in Ireland. Zelensky was received at government buildings in Dublin by an honor guard and a military band playing the Ukrainian and Irish national anthems. Earlier, he visited President Catherine Connolly at her official residence. He wrote in the visitor's book, "On behalf of the people of Ukraine, I express my sincere gratitude for Ireland's steadfast support during our fight against Russian aggression." Officer recalls confronting Luigi Mangione during manhunt in UnitedHealthcare CEO shooting. A Pennsylvania police officer testified Tuesday about confronting Luigi Mangione during an intense manhunt last year for UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson's killer. As soon as Mangione doffed his medical mask at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania, Officer Joseph Detweiler said, "I knew he was a suspect whose face had been all over the news since the shooting 5 days earlier on a Manhattan sidewalk. It's him, I'm not kidding. He's real nervous, and he didn't talk too much," Detweiler told a supervisor by phone from the restaurant parking lot moments after meeting Mangione, according to the officer's body camera video. It was played in court Tuesday, the second day of a hearing, about evidence in the case. Mangione indeed said little initially to Detweiler and another officer, giving only what turned out to be a false name, home state, and driver's license. But Detweiler testified that he'd noticed the man's fingers shaking as they interacted and officers patted him down. Over the ensuing minutes, Mangione placidly ate a hash brown as the officers waited for colleagues and claimed they were simply responding to loitering concerns at the eatery. "I was trying to keep him calm," Detweiler told the court, adding that he at one point started whistling over the restaurant's holiday season music to make him think that nothing was different about this call than any other call. Lawyers for Mangione, 27, want to block prosecutors from showing or telling jurors at his eventual Manhattan trial about statements he allegedly made and items authorities said they seized from his backpack during his arrest. The objects include a 9mm handgun that prosecutors say matches the one used in the killing, and a notebook in which they say Mangione described his intent to whack a health insurance executive. The defense contends the items should be excluded because police didn't get a warrant before searching Mangione's backpack. They also want to suppress some statements Mangione made to law enforcement personnel, such as allegedly giving a false name, because officers started asking questions before telling him he had a right to remain silent. The laws concerning how police interact with potential suspects before reading their rights or obtaining search warrants are complex and often disputed in criminal cases. In Mangione's case, crucial questions will include whether he believed he was free to leave at the point when he spoke to the arresting officers, and whether there were exigent circumstances that merited searching his backpack before getting a warrant. Detweiler testified that he never told Mangione he couldn't leave, nor mentioned the New York shooting. Defense lawyers, however, have argued in court filings that officers strategically stood in a way that prevented him from leaving. Mangione, the Ivy League-educated scion of a wealthy Maryland family, has pleaded not guilty to state and federal murder charges. The state charges carry the possibility of life in prison, while federal prosecutors are seeking the death penalty. Neither trial has been scheduled. Mangione's lawyers want to bar evidence from both cases, but this week's hearings pertains only to the state case. Manhattan prosecutors haven't yet laid out their arguments for allowing the disputed evidence. Their federal counterparts have said in court filings that police were justified in searching the backpack to ensure there were no dangerous items, and that Mangione's statements to officers were voluntary and made before he was under arrest. Five witnesses testified on Monday, including a Pennsylvania prison officer who said Mangione told him that, when arrested, he had a backpack with foreign currency and a 3D-printed pistol. Surveillance video showed a masked gunman shooting Thompson from behind as the executive walked to a midtown Manhattan hotel for his company's annual investor conference on December 4, 2024. Prosecutors say delay, deny, and depose were written on the ammunition, mimicking a phrase insurance industry critics used to describe how companies avoid paying claims. Thompson, 50, worked at the giant UnitedHealthcare Group for 20 years and became CEO of its insurance arm in 2021. He was married and had children who were in high school. Mangione was arrested as he ate breakfast at a McDonald's in Altoona, about 230 miles west of Manhattan. The restaurant's manager had told a 911 dispatcher, "I have a customer here that some other customers were suspicious of, that he looks like the CEO shooter from New York." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. NATO chief dismisses concerns about U.S. commitment to the alliance ahead of Ukraine meeting. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte brushed off fresh concern Tuesday about the United States' commitment to the military organization on the eve of a meeting of Allied foreign ministers focused on Russia's war against Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio will not attend Wednesday's meeting, which will unfold during high-stakes negotiations in Moscow and elsewhere in Europe on Ukraine's future. His rare absence at the U.S.-led alliance comes after President Donald Trump's 28-point proposal to end the almost four-year war dismayed European allies and Canada last month. The administration's draft plan suggested that NATO would not expand further, a longtime Russian demand, and that Ukraine would not be admitted, breaking with a years-long promise to Kiev that it has a place at the organization's table. The plan also stated that a dialogue would be held between Russia and NATO, mediated by the U.S., to resolve all security issues and create business opportunities. It was unclear how NATO's most influential member might serve as an important mediator. Speaking to reporters ahead of the meeting, Rutte underlined that Rubio has a busy schedule. He's working extremely hard to take care not only of the situation of Ukraine, but of course many other issues which are on his plate, Rutte said. So I totally accept him not being able to be here tomorrow, and I would not read anything in it. Senior State Department official speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss the internal administration reasoning for the absence said Rubio has already attended dozens of meetings with NATO allies, and it would be completely impractical to expect him at every meeting. Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau will attend instead and press the allies to deliver on their commitment to invest 5% of gross domestic product on defense. Rutte also downplayed contentious parts of Trump's original plan for ending the war, saying that it has been heavily reworked to address European concerns. "You need to start somewhere. You need to have proposals on the table," he said. He added, when it comes to the NATO elements of a deal to end the war against Ukraine, that will be dealt with separately, and that obviously will include NATO. Despite the proposal to rule out Ukrainian membership, the former Dutch Prime Minister insisted that the country remains on an irreversible path to join the world's biggest security organization, as NATO leaders pledged in Washington in 2024. But he underlined that it's politically impossible for Ukraine to become a member, which would require the unanimous agreement of all 32 allies. The Trump administration has ruled that out, and Hungary and Slovakia are also opposed. "Right now, as you know, there is no consensus on Ukraine joining NATO," Rutte said. At NATO's last summit in The Hague, Trump reassured European partners when he affirmed the U.S. commitment to Article 5, the collective security guarantee that says an attack on any ally should be considered an attack on all of them. He described the other NATO leaders as a nice group of people and said that almost every one of them said, "Thank God for the United States." But several of his remarks since then seem to place the United States outside the organization it has long led. "We're selling a lot of weapons to NATO, and that's going, I guess, to Ukraine for the most part," Trump said at a White House meeting with Finnish President Alexander Stubb in October. "That's up to them, but they're buying weapons from the U.S. Concerns are also high about a further U.S. troop drawdown in Europe. Romania announced in October that the United States would reduce its military presence in the country by up to 3,000 troops as it focuses on security threats in Asia and elsewhere. The administration is expected to announce its troop movement plans in early 2026. Ukrainian troops near the front doubt the proposed pact with Russia will bring lasting peace. Moving between damp basements and muddy dugouts to fend off constant Russian attacks in the nearly four-year-old war, exhausted Ukrainian soldiers say their motivation is fortified by knowing they're fighting for a higher cause, the defense of their homeland. But as negotiators try to hammer out a peace deal, the troops also believe that Russia remains determined to conquer Ukraine, either now or with a fresh army in a few years' time, no matter what kind of agreement is reached. And they also say Kiev must maintain a sizable military to protect the now 800-mile front line. The armed forces of Ukraine are now the main barrier between peaceful civilian life of Ukrainians and our bad neighbor, said a 40-year-old artillery gunner who spoke to the Associated Press near the border between the Dnipropetrovsk and Donetsk regions. He identified himself only by his call sign of Kelp, in keeping with military protocol, and on condition his exact location is not revealed. The soldiers expressed strong doubts that Moscow can be trusted to abide by any peace deal. Without substantial security guarantees, such as NATO membership for Ukraine, they and military analysts believe a new Russian invasion with fresh troops and equipment is inevitable. Seeing future Russian threats from a dark mud-walled trench where he was sheltering to avoid buzzing enemy drones, Kelt fears any peace will be short-lived. This truce will be short-term to restore Russia's forces for some 3 or 5 years, and they will come back, said the former furniture salesman from Kiev, as the sound of booming artillery reverberated around him. Serhiy Filimonov, the commander of the Da Vinci Wolves battalion, worried that a deal would give Russia everything it needed to attack again. I think it would be nice for the Russians to end the war, remove the sanctions, prepare for a new war, and attack again, he said. I don't believe there can be peace before Russia is destroyed, or at least the leadership is changed. Ukraine's overstretched manpower. Filimonov described how Russian troops had briefly entered the eastern town of Pokrovsk, a key logistics hub in the Donetsk region, but were pushed out. His brigade had managed to hold its stretch of the defensive line, but were often let down by neighboring units filled with inexperienced recruits. The Kremlin on Monday boasted that Russian troops captured the city after more than a year of fighting, but Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said in Paris that fighting was still ongoing. A major breakthrough by Russian forces will depend on Ukraine's ability to increase and sustain its troop numbers, said a American military analyst and academic Rob Lee. Ukraine lacks manpower, lacks reserves, he said. All it takes is for one Ukrainian brigade to really struggle, and then Russia can advance. Taras Shmut, a Ukrainian military expert and fundraiser, told public broadcaster Suspilne on Friday that many battalions on the front are made up of only 20 fighters instead of the usual 400 to 800. Even though Ukraine may be mobilizing up to 30,000 recruits per month, many of them find a way out of serving or prove to be unfit to replace frontline troops. Key sites are still being held. Nevertheless, Ukrainian forces are managing to hold their grounds in places like Pokrovsk, as well as in Kupiansk and Vovchotsk in the Kharkiv region, two sites on the front that Russia has been trying to capture for over a year, said Yuri Fedorenko, commander of the Achilles UAV brigade that is fighting in the area. Russia has poured tens of thousands of soldiers at the towns, he said, noting that its failure to capture them testifies to the high motivation and resilience of the Ukrainian army. Russian President Vladimir Putin said last week the fighting won't stop unless Ukraine withdraws troops from the regions of Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhzhia, and Kherson, the four provinces Moscow illegally annexed in September 2022. Russian troops occupy only half of Zaporizhzhia and Kherson, and two-thirds of Donetsk. The draft of U.S.-Russia peace plan stipulated that Ukraine's army be limited and that Kiev's forces must effectively withdraw from the rest of the Donetsk region. Zelensky has said since that a subsequently revised version could be workable, but it's unclear what will be in the final document. Lee, who regularly visits the front, said Russia is advancing at a faster pace in 2025 than the previous year, but it is not a given that Moscow would capture the remaining third of the Donetsk region in 2026. Wherever Russia advances, Ukraine kind of prioritizes defenses, and they can hold for a long time. But then Russia advanced in other directions, Lee said, describing Moscow's progress through Donetsk by simultaneously pushing in multiple directions. Ukraine will still need Western aid. From his muddy trench, Kelt ridiculed the proposal to reduce the size of Ukraine's military, saying it was tantamount to making it easier for Russia to kill you later rather than now. But sustaining an army of Ukraine's current size of just over 1 million would be nearly impossible without continued Western support. Since the war began in 2022, Ukraine has spent almost all its tax revenue on feeding, clothing, housing, and arming its military. The rest of its expenditures for healthcare, social programs, education, pensions, and energy have been financed by Western grants and loans. The European Union allocated $50 billion in aid from 2024 to 2027 as part of the Ukraine Facility Program, but Kiev will need $83.4 billion for the military and $52 billion for the rest of the state expenditures for 2026 and 2027, said Gleb Boryak, Associate Professor of Economics at the Ukrainian-American Concordia University. Ukraine's future finances, including its ability to maintain an army, depends on what the peace plan includes regarding Russia's frozen assets, said Buryak, noting the risk of a drop in aid if the war ends. How they will be managed will determine Ukraine's financial situation over the coming years, he said. Austrian police say two Ukrainians arrested after body found in burnt-out car. Austrian police said Tuesday that two suspects have been arrested in Ukraine after the body of a 21-year-old man was found in a burnt-out car in Vienna last week. The police statement said the motive was unclear, but withdrawals from the victim's crypto wallet were detected and a large amount of cash was seized from the suspects. Motive of greed, therefore, seems likely. Police said they could not give further details on the victim's identity due to privacy rules, but Austrian news agency APA said he was a Ukrainian citizen. Police described the suspects as Ukrainian men, aged 19 and 45, but did not release their names. They were arrested on Saturday. The body was found Wednesday in the back seat of a burnt-out black Mercedes with Ukrainian license plates, police told a press conference. The investigation found the fire was started using gasoline. Investigators found a melted canister on the back seat. An autopsy revealed signs of massive force blunt trauma, suggesting the man could have died before the car was set on fire, according to Gerhard Winkler from the Vienna State Criminal Investigation Office, APA reported. The news agency said Ukraine's government had asked Austrian officials that the criminal proceedings take place in Ukraine. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. More than 1,300 dead from floods in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Thailand as rescue efforts intensify. Emergency crews race to reach survivors and recover more bodies Tuesday as the death toll from last week's catastrophic floods and landslides surged past 1,300 in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Thailand, with nearly 900 people missing. Days of heavy monsoon rains inundated vast areas, leaving thousands stranded and many clinging to rooftops and trees waiting for help. The flooding and landslides killed at least 1,338 people, 744 in Indonesia, 410 in Sri Lanka, 181 in Thailand, and 3 in Malaysia, authorities said Tuesday. Sri Lanka's president, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, said it's too early to determine the exact number of dead in his country. In Indonesia, the hardest-hit nation, rescuers struggled to access villages on Sumatra Island, where roads have been washed out and bridges collapsed. At least 551 people remain missing, according to the country's National Disaster Management Agency. Helicopters and boats have been deployed, but officials warn that worsening weather and damaged infrastructure are slowing operations. Indonesia's forests in ruins. Floods and landslides in North Sumatra carried away millions of cubic meters of felled timber, officials said, sparking public concern that illegal logging may have contributed to the disaster. Batang Toru, the lush forested area, has turned into a wasteland of broken logs and shattered homes. Roads have vanished, replaced by rivers of sludge. This is not just a natural disaster, it's a man-made crisis, said Rianda Purba from the Indonesian Environmental Forum, an activist group. Deforestation and unchecked development have stripped Batang Toru of its resilience. Without urgent restoration and stricter protections, these floods will become the new normal. Survivors desperately search for their loved ones. A week after flash floods and landslides swept through West Sumatra, survivors were still awaiting news of their loved ones. Zahari Sutra held photos of his missing wife and two daughters, aged 4 and 2, as he pleaded for help with rescuers in Sikumbang Village in Agam District. Other victims have been found. Why not my family? The 38-year-old farmer said he dropped his motorbike and ran for higher ground when rising waters blocked his path to home last Thursday. He said the raging current swallowed his home. He waded through the water, shouting for his wife and daughters, but there was only silence. As darkness fell, he found his eldest, a 5-year-old girl, covered in mud but safe. Fearing more floods, Sutra clung to a lychee tree with his daughter until dawn, when the full scope of the disaster was revealed. All homes were gone or buried under tons of mud. I carried my daughter and went for help, he said, his voice breaking. My only prayer is to find my wife and children. Sri Lanka counts the dead and Thailand begins cleanup. Military-led rescue teams in Sri Lanka scoured flood-devastated areas for 336 people still missing in the aftermath of Cyclone Ditwa, the Disaster Management Center said Tuesday. Roads were blocked by landslides and bridges have collapsed, making access difficult. In the central city of Kandy, residents struggled without running water, relying instead on bottled water collected from natural springs. Authorities warned that conditions could worsen as more rain is forecast in the coming days. President Dissanayake, speaking in a meeting with government officials, described the disaster as the worst to strike the country in recent history, saying it remains impossible to determine the full scale of casualties. He warned that the death toll is likely far higher than current figures. He said that government agencies were working to reach isolated communities. Saladore Yogara, 35, a resident of Sarasavagama, said he lost his entire family, mother, wife, and 2 children. I can't even think what life is going to be like, he said. Another man, Durekanu Mahoharan, said he lost his wife, daughter, and a house. Only my sons and I survived. Now I am staying with my brother, he said. At least three people were confirmed dead in Malaysia after floods left stretches of northern Perlis state underwater, authorities said. About 6,000 people sought shelter in emergency centers. In southern Thailand, cleanup has begun on streets and in buildings after massive floods affected more than 1.5 million households and 3.9 million people. Authorities are working to restore infrastructure, including water and electricity. Thailand's Interior Ministry said Monday it would set up public kitchens to provide freshly cooked food to affected residents. The first batch of compensation payments of 239 million baht, or $7.4 million, is set to be distributed to 26,000 people, government spokesperson Siripong Angkasakulkiat also said Monday. Pakistan and India spar over overflight permission. Pakistan on Tuesday accused India of blocking a military aircraft carrying humanitarian aid to Sri Lanka, an allegation New Delhi swiftly rejected. Pakistan's foreign ministry said a Pakistan Air Force transport plane had been delayed for more than 60 hours while waiting for India to clear its route through Indian airspace. It said India withheld overflight permission, then issued what Islamabad called an operationally impractical clearance late Sunday that was valid for only a few hours and did not include a return route. Indian officials rejected Pakistan's allegations as baseless, saying they approved the overflight request within 4 hours on humanitarian grounds. Airspace restrictions between India and Pakistan have been in place since April, after a deadly attack in disputed Kashmir triggered a brief 4-day conflict before a ceasefire was reached. Afghanistan's Taliban rulers carry out public execution in sports stadium in eastern city. Afghanistan's Taliban authorities carried out a public execution at a stadium in the eastern city of Khost on Tuesday, putting to death a man who the country's Supreme Court said had killed 13 members of a family, including several children, earlier this year. Tens of thousands of people, including relatives of the victims, attended the execution in the sports stadium, which the Supreme Court said was the 11th carried out since the Taliban seized power in 2021 in the wake of the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. and NATO forces. United Nations Special Rapporteur for Afghanistan, Richard Bennett, posted on X earlier Tuesday that reports had suggested the public execution was imminent and called for it to be halted. Public executions are inhumane, a cruel and unusual punishment, and contrary to international law, he posted. Afghanistan's Taliban rulers have imposed a strict interpretation of Sharia law, which has included a return of public executions, as well as bans on Afghan women and girls from secondary school and university education, and from most forms of employment. According to a statement by the Supreme Court, the execution was ordered after a death sentence was passed down by a court, an appeals court, and the top court itself, and approved by Afghanistan's Supreme Leader, Hibatullah Akhundzada. The man was shot to death by a relative of those he was convicted of having killed, said Khost police spokesman Mustaghfir Gorbaz. The man had been convicted, along with others, of entering a family home in Khost province and shooting to death an extended family, including 9 children and their mother, Gorbaz said. The victim's relatives had been offered the option of forgiveness and reconciliation that would have spared the man's life, but instead requested the death penalty, the court said. During their previous rule of Afghanistan in the late 1990s, the Taliban regularly carried out public executions, floggings, and stonings. Venezuela to continue accepting deported migrants despite Trump's airspace closure assertion. U.S.-operated flights returning deported migrants to Venezuela will continue despite President Donald Trump's assertion that the airspace of the South American country should be considered closed. The government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro on Tuesday announced that the twice-weekly flights will go on following a request from the Trump administration. That reverses a Venezuelan government Saturday announcement indicating that U.S. immigration authorities had unilaterally suspended the flights. An overflight and landing application submitted Monday by U.S.-based Eastern Airlines requests permission for an arrival Wednesday. The application was made public Tuesday by Venezuela's foreign affairs minister. Venezuelans have been steadily deported to their home country this year after Maduro, under pressure from the White House, did away with his long-standing policy of not accepting deportees from the U.S. Immigrants now arrive regularly at the airport outside the capital, Caracas, on flights operated by a U.S. government contractor or Venezuela's state-owned airline. The flights have continued despite U.S. military strikes against vessels suspected of smuggling drugs in the eastern Pacific Ocean and off Venezuela's Caribbean coast. The Trump administration says the strikes are aimed at drug cartels, some of which it claims are controlled by Maduro. Trump also is weighing whether to carry out strikes on the Venezuelan mainland. More than 13,000 migrants have been deported to Venezuela this year on dozens of chartered flights, the latest of which arrived Friday. Israeli forensics experts examine remains handed over by militants in Gaza. Israel on Tuesday said it had received remains handed over by Palestinian militants in Gaza to the Red Cross. They were believed to be the remains of one of two hostages still in the territory, an Israeli and a Thai national. Israel's government said the findings from Gaza had been taken for forensics testing. Palestinian media said they were located in Gaza's northern town of Beit Lahia. The remains of 26 hostages taken in the Hamas-led October 7, 2023 attack that triggered the war have already been returned since a U.S. brokered ceasefire began on October 10. Palestinians killed in Gaza. Israeli fire killed at least three Palestinians in Gaza on Tuesday. An Israeli drone strike killed a videographer in the south, said officials at Nasser Hospital, which received the body. Mahmoud Wadi was killed in Khan Yunis, the hospital said. Wadi owned a drone photography company that once specialized in filming occasions like weddings. More recently, it posted footage of Gaza's destruction. Also Tuesday, one man was shot dead near the Biroush refugee camp in central Gaza, according to Al Alda Hospital, and another man was killed by Israeli fire in the Gaza City neighborhood of Zeitoun, according to Al Ali Hospital. The Israeli military said in a statement that troops operating in Gaza had killed three people it said posed a threat when they crossed into area Israel controls in the territory. It said troops fired on two people in southern Gaza and one in northern Gaza, though it was not immediately clear if these were the same casualties as those reported by hospitals in Gaza. Gaza's health ministry said more than 350 Palestinians have been killed across the territory since the ceasefire. Both Hamas and Israel have accused the other of breaking the terms of the truce. The initial 2023 Hamas-led attack on southern Israel killed around 1,200 people, while 251 were taken hostage. Almost all of the hostages, or their remains, have been returned in ceasefires or other deals. Gaza's health ministry said the Palestinian toll has topped 70,100. The ministry operates under the Hamas-run government. It is staffed by medical professionals and maintains detailed records viewed as generally reliable by the international community. Violence in the West Bank. Israel's military has also pushed forward its operations in the occupied West Bank, shooting and killing two Palestinians on Tuesday and accused of attacking soldiers. The military said troops shot and killed a suspect who stabbed and lightly wounded two soldiers as they confronted him near an Israeli settlement in the central West Bank. It said the incident was under review. In the southern West Bank, the army said it fatally shot a Palestinian who had carried out a car-ramming attack that wounded a soldier. The army said the man attempted to flee as they tried to arrest him. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the suspects as an 18-year-old from north of Ramallah and a 17-year-old resident of Hebron. Israel's military has stepped up its activities in the West Bank since the war in Gaza began. Israel says the offensive is aimed at rooting out militants. Palestinians say scores of stone throwers, protesters, and uninvolved civilians have been killed. In recent weeks, Israeli settlers have increased attacks on Palestinian civilians. Israel demolishes family homes in West Bank. Israeli forces on Tuesday demolished the family home of Abdul Karim Sanabar, a suspected Palestinian militant currently in detention who has been accused of planting bombs on buses in central Israel in February. Troops evacuated 13 homes around the building in Nablus. Israel says home demolitions are meant to deter future attackers, but critics say they amount to collective punishment against the families of assailants and only exacerbate tensions with Palestinians. The military, which said the explosives in the planned attack didn't detonate, said it demolished Karim Sanabar's family home due to the irregular nature of the planned attack and with the backing of the legal authorities. Israeli troops later traveled to Aqaba town in the West Bank to demolish the house of a man accused of carrying out a shooting attack in which one person was killed, the military said. Tensions with Lebanon and Syria. On Tuesday, Israel's military launched another round of strikes on southern Lebanon, an almost daily occurrence as Israel accuses the militant group Hezbollah of failing to disarm following a U.S.-brokered ceasefire last year that halted 2 months of war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu renewed calls for Syria to establish a large demilitarized buffer zone in the southern part of the country. Israel already holds a 155-square-mile swath of Syrian territory along the two countries' joint border. It says it seized it to prevent militants from moving into the area after Islamist insurgents toppled Assad. Syrian officials have condemned the Israeli incursions as a violation of Syria's sovereignty. On Friday, Israeli forces killed 13 people in a raid on a Syrian village, where they opened fire on residents confronting them, according to Syrian officials. Israel has said such attacks in Lebanon and Syria are against militant groups, but critics say they come with a heavy toll as civilians, including women and children, are often killed. As Pope Leo XIV departed Lebanon on a visit to the Middle East, he made a brief mention of violence in Lebanon's south and called for peace in the region. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Pope in Lebanon asks for a divine gift of peace alongside country's Christian and Muslim leaders. Pope Leo XIV celebrated Lebanon's tradition of interfaith coexistence Monday as a beacon of hope for a conflict-torn region, as he asked for the divine gift of peace alongside the country's Christian and Muslim religious leaders. Leo received a raucous, ululating welcome from the crowds and a sincere welcome from its spiritual leaders on his first full day in Lebanon, where billboards with his image dotted highways around the capital. Thousands of ordinary Lebanese braved a steady rain in the morning to line his motorcade route, some throwing flower petals and rice on his car in a gesture of welcome. History's first American pope is on his maiden papal voyage, and it has taken him to the heart of Christianity, first to Turkey to commemorate a founding profession of the Christian faith, and now to Lebanon to encourage an ancient Christian community in a country that is unique in the Arab world for its religious tolerance. The highlight of his day was an interfaith meeting in Martyr Square in Beirut with the country's Christian patriarchs and Sunni, Shiite, and Druze spiritual leaders gathered under a tent. After listening to hymns and readings from the Bible and Quran, Leo praised Lebanon's tradition of religious tolerance as a beacon for the divine gift of peace in the region. In an age when coexistence can seem like a distant dream, the people of Lebanon, while embracing different religions, stand as a powerful reminder that fear, distrust, and prejudice do not have the final word, and that unity, reconciliation, and peace are possible, he said. Leo's remarks underscored the vital importance of Lebanon and its Christian community to the Catholic Church, a place that St. John Paul II famously said was more than just a country, but a message of freedom to the rest of the world. At the end of the event, the spiritual leaders planted an olive sapling as a symbol of peace. While Lebanon is now often cited as a model of religious coexistence, it hasn't always been that way. The country's civil war from 1975 to 1990 was largely fought along sectarian lines. A visit at a tense time. Leo's visit comes at a newly tenuous time for the tiny Mediterranean country after years of conflict, economic crises, and political deadlock, punctuated by the 2020 Beirut port blast. At a time of conflict in Gaza and worsening political tensions in Lebanon, Leo's visit has been welcomed by the Lebanese as a sign of hope. We as Lebanese need this visit after all the wars, crises, and despair that we have lived through, said the Reverend Youssef Nasser, the Secretary General of Catholic Schools in Lebanon. The Pope's visit gives a new push to the Lebanese to rise and cling to their country. More recently, Lebanon has been deeply divided over calls for Hezbollah, a Lebanese militant group and political party, to disarm after fighting a war with Israel last year that left the country deeply damaged. Despite a ceasefire, Israel has carried out almost daily airstrikes targeting Hezbollah members. The Grand Sunni Muslim Mufti of Lebanon, Abdul Latif Durian, welcomed Leo at the interfaith event and recalled the good relations forged by his predecessor, Pope Francis. He cited the 2019 Joint Statement on Human Fraternity, signed by Francis and the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, the seat of Sunni learning in Cairo, Sheikh Ahmad Al-Tayyib. Lebanon is the land of this message, Durian said. A top Lebanese Shiite Muslim cleric, Ali Al-Khatib, deputy head of the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council, urged Leo to help Lebanon end Israel's attacks amid rising concerns in the Mediterranean country of wider Israeli strikes. We put Lebanon in your hands so that maybe the world helps us, Al-Khatib said. A prayer at a saint revered by Christians and Muslims. Leo opened his day by praying at the tomb of Saint Sharbel Maklouf, a Lebanese saint revered by many Christians and Muslims. Every year, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims, Christian and Muslim, visit the tomb at the hilltop monastery of Saint Maroun, overlooking the sea at Anaya, around 25 miles from Beirut. Bells rang out as Leo's covered Pope mobile snaked its way through the rain to the monastery, where Leo prayed quietly in the darkened tomb and offered a lamp as a gift of light for the community there. Leo was moving through Lebanon in a closed Pope mobile, a contrast with Francis, who eschewed bulletproof Pope mobiles throughout his 12-year pontificate. Lebanese troops deployed on both sides of the roads all along his motorcade routes, but his warm welcome underscored the joy his visit had brought. Many Lebanese posted footage of the welcome alongside a widely shared hot mic video of Queen Rania of Jordan during an October visit to the Vatican, asking Leo if it was safe to go to Lebanon. Leo's response, "Well, we're going," had cheered Lebanese who were otherwise offended by the suggestion that Lebanon wasn't safe for the Pope to visit. Leo ended the day at a jubilant rally of Lebanese youth at Kirki, the seat of the Maronite Church, where he sought to encourage them to persevere and not leave the country as many others have done. "This is an unforgettable moment," said Noel Gossain, a Maronite Catholic, who welcomed the Pope with a group from her church. "We are so proud because we are Christians, so proud." A plea for Christians to stay. Today, Christians make up around a third of Lebanon's 5 million people, giving the small nation on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean the largest percentage of Christians in the Middle East. A power-sharing agreement in place since independence from France calls for the president to be a Maronite Christian, making Lebanon the only Arab country with a Christian head of state. The Vatican sees Christian presence as a bulwark for the church in the region. Lebanese Christians have endured in their ancestral homeland, even after an exodus following the country's civil war. The region has also seen Christians from Iraq and Syria fleeing in large numbers after the rise of the Islamic State group, which was defeated in 2019 after losing its last stronghold in Syria. "We will stay here," said Maynoon, a pilgrim waiting for Leo outside the St. Charbel Monastery. "No one can uproot us from this country. We must live in it as brothers because the church has no enemy." Bishop Antoine Charbel Tarabay accompanied a group of 60 people from the Lebanese diaspora in Australia, not only to welcome Leo and join in his prayer for peace, but also to reinforce Christian presence in the country. "Even though we live abroad, we feel that we need to support young people and the families to stay here," he said. "We don't like to see more and more people leaving Lebanon, especially Christians." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 2nd issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Brian. Thank you for listening.